The United States entered the Vietnam War in earnest in 1964 after a controversial incident in the Gulf of Tonkin. The incident was an attack on an American destroyer, the Maddox, by North Vietnamese PT boats. The outrage and the alleged attack 2 days later on the Turner Joy provoked the U.S. Congress to give President Johnson a free hand in running the war. What no one in the administration explained to Congress was that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was not an unprovoked act. In fact, the American ship was placed off the coast of North Vietnam specifically to be attacked. Once in place, the ship simulated the radio traffic that would take place leading up to an air assault against North Vietnamese ports. The not unforeseeable counterattack became Lyndon Johnson's cover story. Without it, he would have had to pay a too heavy political price for his buildup in Vietnam. The Johnson administration was made up of advisors collectively known as the Whiz Kids, holdovers from the Kennedy White House. They were statisticians and efficiency experts, confident that if the United States could just maintain a certain pace in the war, the enemy would eventually concede defeat. These guys were number crunchers, and they worked for a president who revered politics above everything. As Congress and the public grew concerned about American involvement in Vietnam, Johnson promised to limit American involvement in the war. In reality, he had no intention of doing that and buried the truth in a flurry of statistics. That numbers game was to have a tragic effect on the air war in Vietnam. Johnson did cut the number of American aircraft in Vietnam, but he did it by deploying aircraft to bases off Vietnamese soil in Thailand or Guam, within range of Vietnam. That meant flight crews arriving over drop sites were exhausted from long flights, and that the enemy force they were sent to intercept had long since moved on through the jungle. Militarily, stationing aircraft so far from the battlefield was a bad decision. Numerically, however, it made perfect sense. What was important to the Whiz Kids back in Washington wasn't the real military effect of the mission. What they cared about was the number of planes on the ground and the tonnage of bombs dropped from the sky. In effect, the numbers became the reality. Unlike World War II, where the enemy strength was concentrated in major cities and in vast industrial complexes, in Vietnam, the communist strength was concentrated in the rural areas. It was there that the anti-Saigon government feeling ran the deepest, but the countryside was also where the American strategy of bombing the Vietnamese into submission had the least effect. In Vietnam, with an economy based on subsistence farming and a decentralized enemy, it would be hard to imagine a less effective weapon than massive air power. General Curtis LeMay had promised to bomb the North into the Stone Age, but that boast was lost on a foe whose society had barely progressed beyond the Stone Age. The air war in Nam was called Rolling Thunder. It was a two-tiered approach to air war. Closest to the fighting on the ground were the smaller aircraft, the F-1s, O-5s, and the 104s. They worked down low and fast, doing the job that in earlier wars would have been done by artillery. When troops on the ground engaged the enemy, they called in an air response and got the hell out of the area. The fast movers would then come in, hauling napalm, and burn everything within a mile of the drop coordinates, including the enemy. The second tier was the B-52s, flying in from Guam in Thailand, each dropping 30 tons of bombs. One B-52 flying alone could wipe out an area the size of 10 football fields. And the U.S. Air Force sent waves. The air war changed forever when the North Vietnamese started taking delivery of Russian surface-to-air missiles. The SAMs were installed to protect North Vietnamese cities from American bombers, making Hanoi, the North Vietnamese capital, the most heavily defended city in the world. As the Soviets moved anti-aircraft missiles into the north, Washington sent word to the air crews that the launch sites were not to be bombed while under construction because the Russian technicians were building the batteries. The White House feared the repercussions should Soviet technicians be killed. For months, American aircraft would fly over undefended SAM sites, watching the construction, and then be ordered back to attack those exact sites when the enemy was able to shoot back. The losses were staggering. To counter the SAMs, Air Force commanders came up with one of the most harebrained and successful tactics, the Wild Weasels. The Wild Weasels were pilots flying F-105s and later F-104s who would fly ahead of the main flight, painting himself on the enemy radar and hanging around in the kill zone of the SAMs long enough for the ground battery to take a shot at him. Once the Vietnamese lit up their radar, the sites were easy to find and destroy. It did not take long for the North Vietnamese to recognize the tactic, but it still left them with no good way to respond. The Weasels would strike hard and fast to remove the fang from the enemy's air defense. As the size and effectiveness of the CIBG continued to grow, the Joint Chiefs began to doubt that the CIA had the personnel and resources to manage all the Special Forces troops now in the country. As the Special Forces operations continued to win hearts and minds, Washington made a fatal decision. They switched tactical command of Green Beret operations from the CIA to MACV. Once MACV had command of the CIDG program, the mission began to change. For both the SF troops and the local strike force, the change was for the worse. MACV understood neither the nature of special operations nor the requirements of counterinsurgency. From the beginning, MACV viewed the Berets' involvement in the CIDG program as too static.
Well, in 64, actually, is when it begins. There's a decision to use Special Forces as a long-range reconnaissance function, and it takes two basic forms. The first form is the Greek teams, if you will, the Sigma and Omega teams, which are rather large, fairly large groups of 25 special forces with hatchet teams to back them up, which were indigenous SIGs. It could be as large as 100. And what they would do is they would go into enemy base areas inside South Vietnam, usually on reconnaissance missions, but they were big enough that they could handle any trouble. And if they needed, they could call on air support artillery or these hatchet teams to back them up. And they did that a lot, particularly in the Southern Central Highlands and in the Three Corps region, well west of Saigon, over on the Cambodian border. And then also in 64, there is the formation of the Studies and Observations Group, which is SOG, which becomes quite famous. It's a covert arm, cross-border arm of SOG, most basically. There are other services involved in it, but it's mostly special forces. And what SOG is a realization that, a political realization, that the prohibition against American operations in Laos and Cambodia and North Vietnam is counterproductive. You just can't fight a war that way. Normally, you would have sent reconnaissance elements, big reconnaissance elements, in an overt way into the base areas in Laos, and then you would have invaded them if you found the army. But that's off limits, so SOG has to do that. So it's a covert operation. Special forces with very large limitations on them are allowed in certain areas of Laos to start out with and Cambodia later on. Laos is beginning in 65. Cambodia beginning in 66, to search out the base areas, get intelligence, and call in airstrikes.
As a result, the Green Berets were removed from the role of administering the CIDG program and reassigned to providing surveillance along the Cambodian and Laotian borders. Now, the Shadow Warriors would conduct offensive missions against the belly of the beast, Viet Cong support bases.
Well, we were playing in their backyard. Basically, the VC, Viet Cong, who were South Vietnamese fighting against the Vietnamese, we were basically going into their territory and saying, we can play this game too.
By 1965, U.S. ground forces were pouring into Vietnam, and the newly established 5th Special Forces Group was actively taking action against the Viet Cong infiltration routes. The standing order was to find, fix, and destroy the enemy forces where they live. The team was flown in by unmarked Hueys that would touch down on a number of clearings before the A-team would jump out and head for cover on the run. Bob Wessel was the door gunner.
We were flying a special forces group into Cambodia. This was a CIA presidential decision that was made. We were going over in unmarked helicopters and unmarked uniforms.
There was good reason for the unmarked Huey. At the time, the U.S. government was still claiming that they would not violate the neutrality of Cambodia.
Of course, we weren't in Cambodia at the time. And that particular day, that morning, we'd flew out and dropped off 3 Americans and 8 Cambodian mercenaries. And their mission was to, they were along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They were supposed to watch the NVA movement coming down the trail, unmarked trails. And their basic mission was to capture an enemy truck and bring it back.
No sooner did Wessel and his crew fly out of sight when all hell broke loose for the strike force as the Berets and their cadre fought for their lives. The air crews picked up their radio messages.
It's not much time. We was eating our lunch, and we was monitoring them on the radio and the helicopter, and they ran into, they caught hell. They got surrounded. There was a helicopter before us. It was supposed to be first extraction helicopter. Well, he was monitoring the same thing, and his battery went dead, so he couldn't fire his up. So we were second helicopter for extraction. It was Chief Warrant Officer Bill Armstrong. Co-pilot was James Fusel. And there was Gary Land as the other door gunner and myself. We had a James Calvary Special Forces Medic on that helicopter. We were one to go and extract them. I can remember flying towards the area and about treetop level. I was looking down and I could see it was columns of NVA moving in that area. We could see them moving in, you know, which is, there's some buck kickers. Yeah, they're regular army. They're good. But I remember going in and it was an area where it was a lot of trees. We had a drop, hover, and drop straight down into the air.
The Special Forces team was now in a running firefight, desperately trying to make it to the nearest landing zone and the safety of extraction.
So we had landed, and we had moved away from the LZ and basically set up a perimeter and just wanted to see if we were being followed. We saw another team across the valley being infiltrated. We could see them. They were about 5 miles away, and we sat there and we watched the gunships come in. We saw the choppers try to go in and get them out, and we also listened to it on the radio. And that was a very difficult time for us.
The choppers were burning up the turbos, trying to get there in time.
When we dropped down in the air, we just started catching. Well, we started catching fire going in. In fact, they shot all our radio equipment out. So we had no communication with the CNC ship up above. So we were basically on our own. And I can remember landing, and it was just far and far going. I could hear Gary far on the other side, and I was far.
As the Green Berets and the surviving Cambodians reached the LZ and the choppers, the NVA turned their fury on the rescuing slicks and the air crews.
We had a had a lot of incoming rounds, and I remember sitting there far, and I had a bunch of them coming toward me, 15, 20 on my card, and they all went down, and they never came back up. About that time, I thought I heard Gary push bar, and I heard him yell on the other side. And I turned my head to look. And when I turned my head, I got hit 3 times in the chest and once through the neck. And probably by him yelling or something on the other side, probably saying he probably shot me right through the throat. But I didn't pass out, lucky enough, because what happened was I had so much blood on my glasses I couldn't see it. So I had to take the time to clean my glasses off and get them back together again.
As Wessel cleaned his glasses, the battered team piled into the waiting choppers. The undamaged Hueys lifted off. Wessel and his crew members were the only living Americans still on the ground. It was at that moment that something strange occurred. The fire on the left and right sides facing the deadly M16 machine guns of Wessel and Land slackened.
About the time I got done cleaning, they figured out, I guess, they couldn't come through the sides, so they started coming up behind the helicopter. Of course, the R-60s were mounted, you couldn't turn them that far. So I grabbed the M16 and started to get out and spray the area. About that time, I could feel the helicopter start to move. But at the same time, I seen Mr. Armstrong's head's going off. And kind of scary, because I didn't know what happened to him.
As the Huey Slick tried to stay airborne, Wessel looked around at the interior of the damaged ship.
There he landed. I could see him laying on the floor, part of him laying on the floor. And the Special Forces down helicopter, he had been shot. He got shot through the elbow and came out his shoulder. And I found out later on, Gary Land had been shot through the leg, and some of his toes had been shot off. And the only reason he quit firing was they'd shot his ammo off the 60. And I remember we started to fly out of there, and Mr. Calvary, the medic, asked if I wanted a shot at the morphine. I was in pain.
Even though they were in the air, the danger was far from over for the air crew and their SF passengers.
We were flying. I remember starting to fly out and still firing all the way out. I remember we was cutting down. We probably went about 100 yards just cutting treetops out trying to get out of there. And I remember about halfway back, I said, Mr. Armstrong, he came back around and flew the helicopter back.
Life had become more dangerous for the warriors as they took on a mission they knew they were not designed to handle. The A-teams, small in size and equipped for rapid movement, did not carry enough firepower to fight running battles with trained and heavily armed NVA and trail guard regiments. By 1965, in spite of the best efforts of the SFA teams and the strike forces, the situation in Vietnam worsened. By the end of January, the Viet Cong were conducting large-scale operations, less than 50 miles from Saigon. To counter that threat, U.S. forces were about to meet the enemy face-to-face in strength for the first time. In the early years of the U.S. military's involvement in Vietnam, before American troops were fully committed to the fight against the falling dominoes of communism in Southeast Asia, the Army's top brass were haunted by what had happened to the last great colonial power there. Long before they were overwhelmed and forced to surrender at Dien Bien Phu, the French Army had been outmaneuvered and outfought by General Vo Nguyen Giap's Viet Minh. Hiding in the jungles and staying on the move, the Viet Minh harassed and decimated the larger, slower, less mobile French forces. They had an almost supernatural ability to appear out of nowhere, strike quickly and hard, and disappear into the countryside again. The American war planners knew that, like the French, they would find their superior technology and strength reduced, if not canceled out altogether, by the thick jungle with only a few narrow, twisting roads. The unlikely answer came from the Army's experience in Korea. There, the helicopter had proven a quick and reliable way to transport wounded out of combat areas. Its speed and maneuverability suggested a new kind of use for a new kind of war. In 1962, the Army began training its 11th Air Assault Test Division at Fort Benning, Georgia, the same proving ground where it had developed its airborne infantry capability for World War II. more than 2 years, the new cavalry had practiced its art. The quick insertion of assault forces, weapons, and equipment at predetermined landing zones, or LZs, coordinated with artillery and tactical air support in precisely timed movements. In the summer of 1965, the U.S. Army 1st Cavalry Air Mobile was deployed to Vietnam. Their first base camp was at An Ky in Central Highlands, in the 2 Corps' command zone. They would not have long to wait for the first test of the air mobile doctrine. In October 1965, a regiment of the People's Army of North Vietnam, operating in the jungle-covered mountains of Pleiku Province, near Vietnam's border with Cambodia, attacked the U.S. Special Forces camp at Plei Mi, not far from An Ky. Seemingly out of nowhere, in a surprise action reminiscent of the NVA's successful campaign against the French, the enemy emerged from the jungle en masse and laid siege to Plei Mi. When a nearby unit of South Vietnamese regulars moved in to help the Americans, the NVA ambushed them. It was time for the U.S. cavalry to ride to the rescue. It was time for air mobile. The air cab swept into the area where the South Vietnamese units were under attack, using large CH-46 and 47 helicopters to deploy 105mm howitzers to landing zones within range of the communist positions. From there, the howitzers pounded the communist forces, allowing the South Vietnamese to escape and continue on to Plei Mi. At the same time, the air cab was moving its artillery into place near Plei Mi. Hours of heavy and deadly accurate shelling forced the Vietnamese regiment to give up the siege and retreat westward, back toward the Cambodian jungle.
We was firing at zero, point blank, right? And I never forget this. I fired 143 rounds direct fire. We were shooting them as close as we could. I know when the infantry made their sweep to go out and see how many North Vietnamese had been killed, first shell we fired, we assumed it was the first one. It's hard to tell, but the first one we fired, it killed 19 North Vietnamese in the trench. And they had something like 40-some RPGs, the rockets. Can you imagine if we hadn't got them on? And we assumed it was on the first round because not one rocket had been fired from that group. So we assumed the first shell we fired got them. And we felt that that was something that probably saved a lot of lives. I honestly can say that, and everybody in my old unit, they can say it too. I had the best gun crew in Vietnam. Actually, I had the best gun crew in the Army.
The U.S. command immediately ordered Major General Harry W. O. Kennard, commander of the 1st Cavalry Division Air Mobile, to pursue and destroy the enemy. The Army had intelligence reports that at least one full regiment of communist troops, and possibly two, was deployed in the Central Highlands and preparing a major offensive there. Kennard sent the 1st Brigade, 7th Cavalry, into the wilderness west of Plei Mi in pursuit of the retreating North Vietnamese. Unable to see their enemy through the thick canopy of the rainforest, the 1st of the 7th moved west toward the I Drang River Valley and the forbidding Chu Phong Massif. As they went, they employed a technique called reconnaissance by fire, cruising above the treetops, out of the range of small arms fire. Helicopter gunships fired into the dense growth, flushing and then reducing enemy units more or less at random as they waited for the chance to deliver the killing blow. But this was Vietnam, and the enemy was not about to be so easily eliminated, and had plans to deliver a killing blow of its own. In October 1965, elements of the U.S. Army's 1st Air Cavalry had repulsed a massive attack by North Vietnamese Army regulars on the American Special Forces camp at Play Me in the central highlands of Vietnam. Now, in mid-November, under orders from the Air Cav commander, Major General Harry Kennard, the 3rd Brigade of the 7th Cavalry, the storied Gary Owen Brigade, had taken up the Air Cav's search and destroy mission to find and finish off what remained of the NVA forces that had attacked Play Me. Colonel Thomas W. Brown, commander of the Gary Owen Brigade, assigned Lieutenant Colonel Harold G. Moore and his 450-man 1st Battalion 7th Cavalry to make an air mobile insertion into the valley of the I Drang River. The location was about 20 miles west of Play Me at the foot of the Chu Pong Mountain, and General Kennard and Colonel Brown thought it was the most likely place to find the communist regulars. On November 14, 1965, after making 2 reconnaissance overflights of the target area and identifying several possible landing zones, LZs, Moore selected LZ X-ray, a wide, irregularly shaped clearing between 2 dry ravines overgrown with elephant grass. Just after 10 in the morning, Moore's supporting artillery laid down a heavy barrage in the area of the LZ X-ray. At 10:48 a.m., Moore's were the first boots on the ground as the 16 Air Cav Hueys delivered 2 platoons of his B Company to the landing zone. As Moore set up his command post, 2 platoons moved into position at the perimeter of the LZ on what would become the assault force's right flank. Half an hour later, choppers brought in a 3rd platoon of B Company and 1 of A Company. The B platoon immediately moved out to the perimeter, taking up a reconnaissance position to the left of the first 2 platoons. The A Company platoon set up in the center of the LZ to act as security for the landings. As 2 more platoons from A Company were shuttled in, the 2 forward platoons of B Company, doing reconnaissance on the right flank of the LZ, encountered elements of the NVA's 7th Battalion 66th Regiment, and the firefight began. Without notice, Moore and his men had landed at the doorstep of 2 full communist infantry regiments, the 66th and the 69th. The enemy, through massive reinforcements through the jungle to the other side of the LZ, attempted to flank the badly outnumbered Americans. By 1:30 in the afternoon, the 3 platoons of B Company were battling for their lives in an intense and confusing firefight on the right flank. Moore ordered his reserves into the fight as a flight of choppers brought in 3 platoons from C Company to stop the flanking maneuver and shore up the American left. With fresh troopers on the ground, Moore ordered his units to form 2 cohesive lines along the west and south of the LZ and move into the tree line to extend the perimeter and secure the landing zone for future airlifts. As the firefight escalated, Moore learned that 3rd Platoon, B Company, had pushed too far out into the jungle on the right flank and had been cut off from the rest of the American forces. Surrounded and taking fire from 3 sides, the 29-man unit was holding on for dear life against more than 200 North Vietnamese. As the afternoon wore on, the NVA escalated their attack on the American positions, determined to overrun them and wipe them out. Moore called in heavy air support from B-52 bombers, operating in the two-core zone, to plaster the jungle around his position as the AirCav's artillery support units continued to pour in fire from nearby landing zone Falcon. Air and artillery support were not as effective as they might have been. The NVA had learned in their war against the French that if they fought in close proximity to their enemy, a strategy they called clinging to the belt, the enemy could not use its air cover and artillery to full effect without killing great numbers of its own men. The Huey pilots braved withering ground fire to make three more lifts, bringing in additional rifle platoons from companies C and D, heavy weapons, and LRP units. At around 5 in the afternoon, the enemies rushed the center of the CAV's line, nearly breaking through, but were driven back by a fresh platoon from Company D. Time and time again, they pressed the outnumbered American troops. As night fell on the I Drang Valley, both sides pulled back and prepared to pass an uneasy night. Neither knew what the dawn would bring. At dawn on November 15, 1965, 13 platoons from rifle companies A, B, C, and D of the 1st and 2nd Battalions, U.S. 7th Cavalry, part of the Army's new 1st Cavalry Air Mobile, waited anxiously for the rising of the sun. They were dug in along the western and southern perimeters of a jungle clearing in the valley of the I Drang River in the Vietnamese Central Highlands province of Pleiku. In the dark jungle that lay between them and the 2,300-foot Chu Phong Massif, which separated Vietnam from Cambodia, two full infantry regiments of the People's Army of Vietnam were hunkered down and preparing to attack. The Americans knew the attack would come. They knew also that the enemy outnumbered them, perhaps by as much as 5-1. The two sides had exchanged heavy fire at close range for almost 11 hours on the previous day. Thousands of communist regulars lay dead, but they had kept coming with increasing savagery. At 6:30 in the morning, the communists launched another savage attack. A combined force of the 7th Battalion, 66th Regiment, and the main force Viet Cong launched a massive assault against the American left flank. Their attack was fast, deadly, and overwhelming. In less than 30 minutes, many of the American units were scattered. The fighting in the center of the line was hand-to-hand. At 700 hours, Moore instructed his radio men to send an urgent message to all American units operating in the zone. Broken arrow. Broken arrow means an American unit is under siege and in grave danger of being overrun. Within minutes, every American plane and artillery unit within range of the call answered, raining death on the horrified NVA in a spectacular display of firepower. at a little after 9 o'clock, the communists had been driven back, and LZ X-Ray was re-secured. Huey's brought in fresh troops from the 7th Cavalry 2nd Battalion to shore up the badly sagging American lines. Throughout the afternoon, 2nd Platoon B Company was cut off from the main force and taking fire from all sides. Finally, at 4:30 in the afternoon, with dusk approaching, Moore ordered Companies A and B to move against the NVA on the right flank to try and rescue the lost platoon. After advancing only 100 meters against heavy resistance, Moore called for white phosphorus artillery to be dropped in the area between the communists and the lost platoon. While the phosphorus burned, the enemy took cover, breaking the rain of fire long enough for A Company to reach and bring back the battered platoon along with its dead and wounded. An hour later, the communist commander pulled his troops back from the LZ X-ray to regroup in the jungle. At noon, Hueys and larger CH-46 and CH-47s began bringing in replacements for the hardest hit units. The battle was over. Landing zone X-ray was secured for the night. The Battle of Ai Drang was the first full-scale military engagement between the American and North Vietnamese armies. Lieutenant Colonel Moore and his men accomplished their objectives. They found and reduced the enemy force that had attacked the Special Forces camp at Play Me and drove it from the Pleiku province, killing more than 1,200 communist troops in the process. At Ai Drang, the Gary Owen Brigade proved that the air cab would be an effective and resilient fighting force, well suited for this new kind of warfare. But the cost was high. In just 2 days of battle, the Gary Owen Brigade lost almost 300 men. It was one of America's greatest battles.
Blue.